All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Very exciting day today. You want me to tell you why? I will tell you why. Maybe you don't know this about me, but today is Anne Hathaway Day. Anne Hathaway was in my garage. Also, I don't want to give short shrift to anybody, but Amy Mann stopped by and played a new song from her new album also today, coming up shortly, delivered into your head. But for those of you who have been with me pre-WTF, back to the Break Room Live days, somewhere in the 2007-2008 area when my life was falling apart, I was working in New York, and I was a shattered emotional mess doing this streaming video show that no one watched, except for those of you who knew the show. How you doing? You've 1,724 people. But at some point, I saw Rachel getting married. And that's a Jonathan Demme film, I believe, yes, starring Anne Hathaway. And I was so taken with her performance and with her that I developed a kind of, all right, maybe it was a little bit of an obsession. I'll admit it was a while ago. I think I can admit that. I will tell her about it. I will be straight with it. But from that point on, I just loved her. I loved her work. I loved her. And it became sort of a running theme on that show for the idea of her maybe stopping by to do an interview on Break Room Live at the old Air America studios on 6th Avenue that nobody watched, could not have been on her radar at all. But I insisted that there was an outside chance that it was. Now, I don't know really what's going on out there in the world around this particular movie star and actress, Anne Hathaway, but I love her, and I'm a huge fan, and I believe she works hard, and she does amazing work always, and I also believe that if you don't like her, especially with some sort of strange intensity, it says more about you. There's something wrong with you. Look within. I guess I'm just telling you this because I was excited to have her here, and that might read a bit. I'm not one for hiding the fanboyness on occasion, but it was great to meet her and talk to her. And the new movie Colossal is an interesting movie. I had to rethink the whole thing. I watched it once, and then I had to go back and think about it more. I'll tell her. I don't need to tell you. And as I said, Amy Mann is here, who the song she plays is fucking excellent. I personally believe that her new record, Mental Illness, is her best record. You know what? I'll tell her that, too. I'm going to tell her that. That's what I'm going to do. So I just got back from Denver and Boulder. Me and the American original, that is Dean Del Rey, did a couple shows there. I like traveling with Dean because we like to do the same things. We enjoy eating food. Now we're both relatively healthy, but he's different. He's got the, I was almost a diabetic, no sugar, no starch thing. And I've got the no meat thing because I have high cholesterol. But you know, we're in the same ballpark. We both like vinyl. And, you know, we will go look at clothing. We will go look at jeans, shirts, jackets, and bags. So, as I said, the crowds were great. And maybe I didn't say that, but I'm saying it now. See, I'm actually a little filled with a tingly nervousness just to introduce the Anne Hathaway show. It's fucking ridiculous. I'm a grown-ass man. Okay? And don't get any fucked up ideas. I am in a healthy relationship with a wonderful woman who paints, and she is married to a nice man, and they have a baby. This is kind of residual remnants of all right. It's a crush. Okay? I said it. All right? So let me talk about this because this is sad news. Last week we lost a couple of comedians, and it's always tragic when people die, but one was just starting to come into her own. And you know, it was really shocking to me and jarring, because when I was in Austin, this is what, a week ago or so, on April 1st, I worked with this woman. Her name was, sadly, LaShonda Lester. And I did not know her. I was sent a few videos of people in the Austin area. I looked at like 4 or 5 different comics. And without a doubt, after seeing her like 8-minute set, I was like, that's her. She's authentic. She's real. She's got her own voice. She's talking about her life. She's hilarious. And I booked her for that show. And I met her on April 1st for the first time. She's a lovely person. Sweet person, but you know, just deep, you know. And she gets up there and she talked about her life, and she had health issues, and she talked about them on stage. And I had the same feeling when I watched her live as I did when I saw her on that video, that you know, just a great comic, you know, an honest comic, and authentic. And that's really the best kind. And it's a great loss to the comic community. It would have been great to see what she could have done with herself. She was getting ready to do a Comedy Central special, and just fucking sad. And my heart goes out to her family and the Austin comedy community, because she was something else. And it's really sad, and it was really shocking. And also, tragic, but 91 is not a bad age to die at. If I can, if you, that's a good run. Don Rickles is dead. He was old. He was great. He had a long, amazing career, a rich life. And he was, I never got to talk to him, but I tried. But he was really one of the funniest people ever. He was one of the guys that planted the seed in my brain that I think ultimately led me to become a comic, quite honestly. Because I remember watching him when I was a kid. I remember watching him it was like an hour special when they used to do those, like variety shows. But it was an hour special. And I remember these weird lines. Like, I think the gimmick was, he was on stage and he was talking to someone in the audience, which was also him, dressed like a schnook. And I remember the line was, nice suit. Did that come with 2 pairs of pants and a yo-yo? And I don't know why I remember that, but it's hilarious. I mean, it doesn't even make sense, really. He just had this amazing timing. And that intensity, he had this intensity that was like barely hiding this rage. And of course, to me and to everybody who loved him, that made him very endearing. I mean, I used to love watching him on the Dean Martin roasts. He was so fucking funny. So fucking funny. There's one line I remember where they're on the dais and, you know, Don's, I don't know if he's at the podium or just further down the dais. And Jimmy Stewart at that point is old, the older man. And Don leans over and looks down at Jimmy. Goes, Jimmy, I spoke to the family. You're doing fine. I just loved the guy, and it's sad, but he did live a good long life. And I gotta be honest with you. You know, to dismiss Don Rickles as being insensitive or incorrect somehow is a real failure to contextualize him properly. And if you think that, you're a fucking hockey puck. He was one of the best, if not the best, of his generation. I loved him, and I'm very sorry I never got to talk to him. We tried a bit. We tried. Amy Mann and I go way back. I've been a fan. I've been a friend at different points in our lives. I have not seen her in a long time. I was thrilled to have her on the show and catch up. And when I got a copy of the new album, I was like, holy shit, this is fucking amazing. She better bring her goddamn guitar. And she did. This is me and Amy Mann, and she's doing a song from her new album called Mental Illness that's available now wherever you get your music stuff. Amy Mann, I don't think, what have you been avoiding me?
Have you been wandering around and
I don't know.
First of all, we're not in the same circles because there are no circles. What are the circles?
There's not any anymore.
There's no circles.
There was some circles for a while, and then some concentric circles, and then the center broke apart, yeah. And then everybody kind of went their way and
that's right.
Had kids and got jobs or something. Yeah. I don't know. There was a time where people hung out. Maybe people still do. I'm not one of them.
There has to be a place to hang out, and
Exactly.
It used to be
your backyard.
The old Largo, which was a long time, our backyard. That's yeah. right. Yeah.
You still there?
In the backyard?
No, in the house. In that house?
Yeah, the backyard looks great.
Does it?
Yeah, you should come over. We totally redid it. It looks fantastic.
All right, maybe I'll come over in the summer.
Yeah.
And now that I'm old, it'll be less awkward.
And make the steak tips.
Sure.
Oh my God, they were so good.
Do whatever. I'll do whatever. It'd be nice to socialize.
Are you a hermit now?
I don't know if I'm a hermit. I just don't know where people have time to do everything. I mean, I don't know where, when people say, did you watch all 90 of those things? I'm like, where the fuck
did you? I know, where do you get the time?
I'm self-employed, but I still don't have any time. Like, I had a couple hours today, so I went to the doctor and I got some skin tags frozen. Very exciting.
That's great.
See, as you get older, your life is more occupied with just maintenance.
Yeah, no, medicals, no. I'm totally with you. I'm like, when am I going to find time to get that dumb blood test so they could check my cholesterol?
Sure.
Like, that's exactly right.
Well, I'll go do that, and then when you find out the results and they're not quite right, then you have a project.
Yeah.
It's like, how do I get that down?
Yeah.
What do I got to eat?
Yeah.
Yeah, shop for specific things.
I guess those steak tips are off the menu now.
For now, they are off
God
the menu.
Damn it.
God damn it is
Why
right.
Why bring this up?
I know. I've been okay without eating. I found that I didn't eat that much red meat to begin with.
Yeah.
So I'm like, and it's kind of nice to eat fish. It makes me go, see, that's another thing I do now. I go to Fish King in Glendale that has fresh fish, and they service the Armenian community and people that need fresh fish. So it's good. And I got a guy there who I tip, and he takes care of me and gives me good fish.
Wait, you greased the fish guy?
Sure. Old school. You got to grease the fish
it's
guy.
It's fantastic.
It's nice.
You have a very involved and intricate life, I feel. So, that's why you're not hanging around backstage at Largo.
I'm a lunatic who likes to shop at three places for specific things. Where do you shop? What is your process?
My husband does the marketing in our
house. Oh,
does he? Yeah, he does the marketing and the cooking.
Mr. Penn goes out and does everything?
That is the only time he goes out because he is a hermit.
He is a hermit. Yeah, but this record, that must have taken you some time. I don't want to talk out of school or be weird or not know, because I've listened to, I can't say that I'm completely familiar with everything you've done, but I think this is like your best record.
Thank you.
Do you?
I really love this record. I'm really thrilled with this record. And, you know, part of it is because it is, what's the record I would make if I didn't care about how people received it? It's the, you know, acoustic, sad, depressing songs about the weirdos I know.
Well, I mean, I just like, I've listened to a lot of your records at different points in my life, but for some reason I put this one on the other day and I'm like, well, this is like mature kind of stuff that she wants to be doing.
Thank you.
I didn't feel any of the, you know, like me thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, exactly. That's exactly right. There's no, it's like, no, you're not going to buy it. We all know that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just do what I want to do.
No, but some of these songs are great. Poor Judge is great. Philly Sinks is great. And I only went through it one and a half times. Roller Coasters is good. A lot of the themes, the Amy Mann themes, those troubled codependent relationships.
Yeah. Oh my God, we love those. We love it. Mark, that's one of the things we have in common. We're so into it.
I'm kind of level. I'm good. I'm in a pretty level thing.
Yeah?
No, I'm not crazy lately.
Well, it's hard to believe, but I'm hands off.
I mean, I don't know. It's I don't even know if it's a. It, I don't wouldn't call it recovered as much as exhausted.
Yeah.
Because at some point, like, it must be a relief, I'm assuming, just to write about these things and reflect. I don't know your life, but I don't know how insane you are. Is there any insanity? Okay.
It's not, you know, they're always, everyone's crazy is the problem. And they're always crazy satellites that orbit you for a while.
Well, let me put it another way.
Vice versa.
How much engaged drama? Yeah, there's crazy everywhere. We're all crazy, but it doesn't mean you have to do the dance.
Yeah, that's the work I do is how to set boundaries. What does the boundary look like? Where do I set it? What does setting it look like? It's all that. So I know you're exhausted just hearing that sentence.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I don't do much. It's like, there's your boundary.
Yeah.
No go.
Yeah, yeah,
not
yeah.
doing it.
No,
can't.
Yeah.
Sorry. Not available. All turned off in there.
Decline.
Yeah. That resource is not available right now. I cannot be your battery, nor can you be mine.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, I guess. But now, is this album is called Mental Illness, and I'm not a rock critic, and I, you know, and I have to struggle to even listen to lyrics because I'm, you know, a dumb melody guy and riff guy, but I listen to all of them. But is there an arc? Is there a theme? Is this a, when you call something mental illness, did you see it as a whole piece? Because there's a nice manageable number of songs on here, Amy, man. Yeah. I was so relieved when I looked at the CD in my car. I'm like, oh my God, this is the last song? Wow, there's not 90 songs on this CD.
Nobody wants 90 songs.
Why do people do it then?
I don't, because they're trying to give them their money's worth. I don't want my money's worth.
No, make a record.
I went just under my money's worth. 11 songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were there more?
There were a couple of more, but I felt like these are the ones that made the grouping, mental illness grouping. You know, some of them, there was a couple there were like, meh, there was a song about, it was like a murder ballad, which I guess, you know, I guess would qualify. But,
sure. A murder ballad.
But it didn't really fit in.
Like old timey murder ballad?
Yeah. From the point of view of the corpse. It was
Of a specific murder?
No, just a creepy, a creepy thing that came to me. I don't know what was going on.
Wasn't based on some weird folk hero you're trying to create?
No, it's called Swanee River, and it was just, you know, I just had this image of it. It's beyond depressing.
Oh, yeah.
Image of a corpse at the bottom of the river.
Ooh, that's lonely.
With like the silt and mud and
the little fishies eating
trees.
It?
Yeah.
Ah.
Anyway, that didn't make the record.
Wow, that sounds like
I drew the line.
Was that the dance number on the record? But what about the theme? Did you feel like there was a theme, or was that something you kind of put on it on the end?
I felt like while I was writing this record, or just before, I was having encounters with people that there were a little more specifically could be classified, you know, not just sort of everyday crazy, people with real mental illnesses.
Like people in your life, or just people at the store, or people?
No, people I intersected with.
Yeah?
Yeah, but...
Yeah, it's wild when that happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's more wild is when you find out someone you've known for years is like that day you're like, oh, shit, you're much more fucked up than I ever imagined.
Yeah, yeah.
Some
exactly.
of those?
Yeah. Yeah, like, oh, you're taking lithium? Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
I mean, like, no judgment, obviously,
because
you and I are about as crazy as we can be.
Yeah. But it's good they're medicating if they need that.
Yeah.
But you just didn't know that that person was, the poles were that separated.
Yeah, or rather it explained some stuff.
Sure, sure. Well, it should explain that, gee, this could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, I know.
I guess that's one highlight of finding out someone's on medicine. It's like, thank you.
Yeah,
that answers a lot of questions. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you just had a lot of energy and didn't sleep very much and talked a lot.
You're very creative.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Oh, he's not doing his lithium right then. If that's still happening, if he's still up for a few days with the big ideas. Yeah. But what was this thing you did with Ted Leo?
Ted and I had, or we still have, a band called The Both, and we wrote and recorded a record right after my last record. My last record was called Charmer, and then we went on tour with each other. He opened for me.
Yeah.
And we became really good friends. And
that was the first time, like, that recently?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a couple, 3 years.
Because you guys
like
are sort of the same orbity people to me. Yeah.
I knew him and I knew his music, but he was doing a solo thing. And as I was watching the solo thing, I was like, I feel like if I put bass to this, it could be like, I sort of heard how a duo would sound.
Uh-huh.
And I was really eager to play bass again, and that was just super fun. And it was, I don't know, I also think that I'm really in the mood to collaborate with people. I don't have that like, I gotta prove that I'm a great songwriter all on my own, every word has to be mine. And it's really fun to collaborate with people.
And you're playing bass?
Yeah.
So it's just bass and he's on acoustic?
Yeah. No, he's on electric.
Oh, really?
And when we tour, we have a drummer. So
oh, you
it's
do.
A power
so,
trio. Yeah.
So
but we do a lot of shows, just the two of us.
And you're writing together as well?
Yeah.
Have you recorded?
Yeah, we did an album.
Called The Both.
The Both.
How was that?
It was, I love it. It
now I have to
really
get that
fun.
Now.
Yeah.
Like I've been,
now
I,
you're two behind.
I'm plenty behind.
Yeah.
But like Ted, I knew years ago briefly, in New York, and I haven't really listened to his stuff in a long time either. He's a good pop guy.
He's a really good songwriter, and his guitar playing is so interesting.
Yeah.
His soloing is so interesting. It's melodic, but it has this sort of punky thing that feels like it's about to fall apart in a really interesting way. So yeah, I'm really into him. You know, so it's fun to do a power trio thing.
Wow.
You know?
So because he can hold up his end.
Yeah.
Well, who are the people on this record? Are they your regular crew? Or?
Jonathan Colton is on it because Jonathan does like
a lot. Or
he is like
a
real.
Little?
We wrote a couple songs together.
Really?
I wrote a song with this guy, John Roderick, who's...
Which songs did you write with Jonathan Colton?
Roller Coasters and Patient Zero and Why Am I Forgetting? Oh, Good For Me.
That Philly Sinks, is that about a guy that's like the same guy from every song you've ever written?
The dry drunk now is like sex and love addict. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. That guy, yeah, the recurring guy. Theme. So there is a through line,
there's,
right?
You know, these people are endlessly fascinated to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that's the difference between you and me. My fascination, it wanes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's nice to have a bit of a distance instead of like... Right.
Well, sometimes it's just sort of like, again?
Yeah.
Really? Like, I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And like, they become easier. People become easier as they become more predictable.
Yeah.
But that implies, like, if you stay in those kind of engagements, so that implies something about you, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I find myself in the same kind of dynamics over and over. I mean, you know, but you have to look at it like, here's an opportunity to practice, you know. Yeah,
I'm going to use this guy that knows me one way and act totally different and see how that goes.
Yeah, well.
Oh, that didn't go well. Now I'm back in the old shit.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, a lot of it is like... practicing like okay yeah. what practicing boundaries and uh-huh. like you said sometimes the boundary is like I can't. You know I can't
yeah.
know you
yeah
yeah
I can't sometimes I can't even open emails that's how tight yeah. my boundaries are
yeah
can't do it
just don't
throw,
even
I'm gonna throw
it.
That one right away. Thank God there's like you know like with texting and that kind of stuff. I don't know what happened, but I just became one of those people that goes through my text and I'm like, holy shit, I didn't answer that. You think you answer it in your head?
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, here's the answer in my head.
Yeah, and then it just sits there for a week.
Yeah.
And I'm sad and also elevated and excited that I'm one of those people now. That I'm the person you can text and a week later I'll be like, oh, what's up?
Yeah.
And then you're going, you fucking asshole.
Well, I think that's probably good. I have that, like, I could answer this in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is terrible if you're driving or doing anything or that's trying right. to have any kind
yeah.
of life.
Yeah, I needed a week to tell you I couldn't come over.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah. Now what happens now? Do you go out on the road?
I'm going out on the road April 20th to May 13th.
With this band?
It is pretty much that band.
But when you go now, do you find, do you have these fans that have like sort of aged with you?
Yeah.
Like, grown up, like
yeah.
these people that have been coming for 20 years.
Yeah, some yeah, of them.
Yeah,
think,
like,
yeah.
hey, and you're like, oh yeah, how's it going?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some diehard fans that, you know.
It's nice, right?
Yeah.
In a way? Other than you can see your own mortality reflected in them.
I think it's really sweet. I'm
yeah,
surprised
I do too.
People don't, like, how are you not sick of me?
Right. But then it's challenging because they come, but then they say sort of, you know, they say those slightly passive aggressive compliments. Like, no, it's a lot different than the last one.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, what do you mean? No, it's good.
No, it's good. Yeah, it's good. That like
well,
high
thank
voice.
You.
Oh, nice no, I like it. Oh, I liked it.
Nice to see you too. What song do you play when you play songs from this record?
This will be the first time I have ever played a song from this record.
I'm gonna try it out.
I'm gonna play the song "Patient Zero" because I sort of know it, even though I think I'm gonna get. Take my lyric crib sheet just in
oh,
case.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Jay Maskus has an entire book of everything he's ever written.
Yeah, I have that somewhere. I mean, it's a little heavy to
As we get older, you're going to have to pull that out.
Why leave it to chance?
Well, right? You can just Dylan it and just garble your way through things. All right, here, I'll shut down and we'll set up.
Someone carried you back. From here on out, your patient zero. Smelling ether as they hand you the rack. Life is good. You look around and think I'm in the right neighborhood. But honey, you just moved in. Life is great. despair. Carmen Stern would probably pull that trigger for fun. And in the hills where hope is such a constant companion, close enough to almost touch the lights of the canyon. The lights of the canyon. The news filtered over the transom that a villain ended up with a part. You paid your respects like a ransom to a moment that was doomed from the start. Life is good, you look around and think I'm in the right neighborhood, but honey, you don't belong. Life is grand, and wouldn't you like to have it go as planned? Go as planned. And in the hills where hope is such a constant companion, close enough to almost touch the lights of the canyon, the lights of the canyon, the lights of the canyon.
Did I start clapping too soon?
No, it's perfect. Thank
Sounded
you.
Sounded so good. I really love this
Thank
record.
You, Mark.
I'm very happy for you. So what is, like, with something like this, this album, when you do a single, what is a single on this one in your mind?
There really isn't a single. I have a couple of songs I made videos for because I just had ideas for videos, and
doesn't work like that anymore,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, this song there's a video for, and I just made a video for the first song on the record, "Goose Snow Cone."
Now, can I ask you a dumb question? Because I'm trying to be more lyrically sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, like, some, you know, poetry is poetry, and, you know, it means what you want it to mean sometimes, and, you know, you get whatever emotion you get out of it. But what is a goose snow cone?
Well, it's a dumb thing that really existed only in my mind, and I was going to replace it with something, but I couldn't think of a thing to replace it with. I mean, I feel like you will relate to this a little bit. There's a cat that belongs to a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And the cat is often in their Instagram account.
Yeah.
And she's white and fluffy. And I was on tour and feeling really homesick.
Yeah.
And I saw a picture of this cat with its little white, fluffy, snowball-like face.
Right.
And so I was writing this song about being homesick and sort of lonely. And it was snowing. I was in Ireland and it was snowing and depressing. And I was, you know, but I couldn't figure out what to replace it with. That,
right.
You know, so
yeah.
I just was like, fuck it. I'm going to just have to explain it every time people ask.
You think people will ask?
They
already have?
Yeah, they ask.
Goose snow cone.
Well, because you can't imagine what it is.
It's, well, yeah, because you like a snow cone.
Yeah.
That takes you somewhere.
Yeah.
And you're like, what's a goose snow cone?
Yeah.
And but what do you say generally other than just that? Can't you just say, hey, well, don't fucking bother me.
Yeah.
it's poetry, man.
Yeah. I get to have some kind of leeway.
Yeah.
It means whatever I want it to mean.
You're the songwriter.
It's about a cat. So
okay.
I made the video about the cat. The cat
explains everything.
Is in the video.
A lot of good turns of phrase, some smart, wise stuff on this
Thank
record.
Thank you, Mark.
Nice seeing you. Holy shit. It always amazes me when performers come in here and just knock it, just kill it with the one take business. Man, I can't get through a whole song, but I'm not a professional musician. I don't do it for a living. It's just when they lock in, when especially Amy, and this happened twice, when she locks in, it's like, oh my God, I'm just sitting here just listening, trying to not look directly at her in awe of the amazing sound and singing. She's great. The new record is called Mental Illness. So here we go. This is it. Anne Hathaway came over here and sat in here, right over there. The new movie that she's in is Colossal. It's now playing in New York and L.A. It opens in theaters across the country this Friday, April 14th. And I think I kept it together during this interview. That I'll preface it with that. And that I think she's great. For real. All right, this is me and Anne Hathaway. I mean, I know Glendale. I've worked in Glendale. I've been to Glendale. I go to Glendale sometimes. There's parts of Glendale I like, but I don't know if I would just blanketly say
I like
Glendale.
What sort of things do you blanketly like?
Like geographically?
Sure.
I like Northern California. I can go blanket on Northern California, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Washington State, mm-hmm, along the coast, I like. New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I talking so much? What about you?
I like Northern California.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a blanket one, the ocean.
Really?
Blanket, love the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could live without it, but I don't find myself going there much. Do you find yourself like, how long you lived in LA?
Off and on since I was 16.
All right, do you take the day and go, I'm going to the ocean?
Well, I can't in LA because I'm extremely pale.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of like stuff you have to bring with you just is just irritating.
What about the trip itself?
The trip itself is irritating. But when I'm on the East Coast, I make it a point to go to the beach a lot.
Oh yeah, where like Long Beach? Or like Asbury Park, where you...
Asbury Park I've been to, but I go to Cape May, New Jersey.
Okay. Oh, well, you're like Jersey girl, right?
Yeah, well, I was born in Brooklyn, but raised in New Jersey.
New Jersey. I'm born in New Jersey.
Where?
Jersey City.
I love having Jersey in common with people. I'm from Milburn.
I'm trying to think where Milburn is, because I got out at like six, but my grandparents...
That's when I got in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My mom's family, Pompton Lakes... which is by Wayne,
mm-hmm,
and Morris County.
Yeah, I played soccer against all of those towns.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What were you? You're a big soccer player?
Growing up, I was exceptionally mediocre, but I did play a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad worked really hard
to make you a boy.
Clearly, he succeeded. It's like a little bit, but no, he worked really hard as a lawyer in Manhattan. And I talked to him about it recently, and he said, I made a choice as a lawyer that whatever it meant for my career, I was always going to be home on the weekends. And the best way for him to spend time with all of us, because it was me and my two brothers, was through soccer.
Right.
And he would ref our games. Sometimes he was our coach.
Yeah.
He was just an involved parent. But I don't know that it's something I would have chosen if my older brother hadn't. My older brother's really good at it.
Still?
I don't know that it's something I would. He doesn't play as much anymore because he is a kid.
Like, right.
But before he had a kid, he was playing in like a grown-up league.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So it stuck with him.
Yeah.
Like those dudes who play hockey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you play a sport?
No.
No.
I think I'm physical enough. I think I can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not great with competition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everything's very life and death for me.
There's
no. You too?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's like, I'd rather, it's really immature, but I'd almost rather forfeit the game than go through the humiliation.
I've gotten to a place where I can play, like, parlor games at parties.
Okay.
Like, I'm no longer an unpleasant charades player.
Oh.
But I'm a brutally...
You mean one that talks? That's not how you play.
I think I've become. I've made friends with my competitiveness, but deep down, it's savage.
Yeah, it's good to be competitive, but at some point, it's important to learn the lesson of losing like a person.
Oh yeah,
that it's not the it doesn't indicate anything about your being if you lose.
You're right. I remember going back to soccer for a second, like losing a game and crying.
Right. And I think that I've talked about this with other people, and I don't have kids, but I think that the most important thing you could teach them is how to lose with some dignity
so
they can at least enjoy life.
Yeah. And also, because I'm talking about myself, I can say this.
Yeah.
I was crying because I thought it reflected on me. And
right.
So rather than think about my teammates, I was thinking about myself. It's a pretty narcissistic thing to do.
Well, as long as it wasn't like I did it, I'm the one that lost the game.
I could create that narrative, though.
Oh, right.
I was a pretty self-absorbed teenager.
Really?
Shockingly.
Not anymore, though.
For a teenager. I mean, I have moments, but I'm a parent now, so I feel like I can't, that self-absorption doesn't really have room in my life.
Uh-huh. How's that going?
Being a parent?
Being less self-absorbed.
I mean, like I said, I got moments.
You're like a new parent.
I'm a new parent, yeah.
Like a year old or something?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you're like in it. This is a whole new world. When did you shoot that movie? Like right after you had a kid?
While I was pregnant. 4 months pregnant when we made this.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. It was. I was really happy the reaction my director had.
What'd he say?
Well, because I called him and And he said, you know, oh my gosh, this is amazing. He spent 5 minutes just being happy for me. And then he went, oh, wait a minute. What does that mean for the film? Can you do it? And I said, well, I'd like to do it if you'll have
me. Here are the sweaters you'll be wearing.
Well, and he said, your character's a drunk. You're bloated. It's perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
And it actually does work.
It does read that way.
And it was fun. I ate so many muffins.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Because you're feeding the kid, too.
Feeding the kid.
I think that's one of the fun parts of being pregnant, right?
Absolutely.
But this movie, I watched it on my TV. I plugged my computer into the TV, old school.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have Apple TV, though. You can just do it by with a button. But nonetheless, I watched it, which is good, right?
That you watched it?
Yeah.
I'm so relieved. Yeah. It did cross my mind coming over here how difficult it would be to talk about it. Well, it's difficult to talk about anyway, but...
But don't you... Do people do that, though? Because there's times where I've had people in that have done a lot of things. Like, I can't say I've watched all your movies, but as I'll reveal, I'm a pretty big fan. So, yes. to the point where it got a little awkward, but you don't even know about it.
Okay.
But this movie is one of those movies. It reminded me a little of like when I saw Unbreakable, where there's something more to what you're seeing. And I couldn't really put it together until after. And I think it runs deeper than you're going to get just from watching it passively.
I would agree with that. And you can watch it passively.
Of course. You know, I did. And then there was that sort of thing where it's like, well, that's pretty good. That's a nice twist. That was worth waiting for. The big twist at the end. How is that going to resolve itself? Oh, holy shit. She went there to do that. So see how I did that? Didn't give away anything.
I'm breathing a lot easier now. Yeah. Thank you.
But then like in thinking about it and then talking to people about it, because it is a peculiar device. I mean, like the narrative device is like, where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah.
Now, when you read that, what were the discussions you had with the director and writer?
It was just a love fest. I know I should have had a more rigorous process for a vetting process or something, but I was just so in. I was just
What was
so
it
in.
About it?
Just what you said, like the where the fuck did that come from quality to it.
Yeah.
I felt so refreshed by the end of it. It made me laugh, and it reminded me of the sort of movies that I dreamed of making when I started. And you know, I don't want to complain about my career; it's been amazing.
Yeah.
But I've sometimes found myself in films that I'm just like, oh, I would have seen this, but I don't know that I would have been first in line to see this.
Oh yeah.
You know? Yeah. And this one is something that it just I felt it really represented my personal sensibilities, the movies that I like. I don't need movies to make sense for them to be enjoyable to me, and the fact that this one did make sense, that there was a thread that went through it, and it was so creatively
wild,
ambitious, and everything about it I loved. I loved her.
Yeah, it must have been mind blowing to read that thing with that moment where you're like, "What? Wait, what? I'm in the playground, and what's happening?"
That aspect of it was so much fun that was one of the things that drew me in, because, you know, when you're a kid and you don't know that you want to be an actor, like as a thought, you're not thinking, what is my career path?
Right.
But you are on the playground and you do see cities around you, and you do see imaginary villains, and they do have capes, and and you do have to figure out how to get that stack of boulders to fall on them, and you see all of it.
Yeah.
And making this was so much fun because I got to go to a playground and do that again.
But what it implies about the strange sort of anonymous, you know, bordering on cowardice of having personalities online, out in the world, doing destructive things, that the metaphor, it didn't resonate till afterwards. And I think it's in there. Do you?
Yeah.
You do?
For sure.
Was it, did you have those kind of conversations with the filmmaker? About like what it implied?
Yeah. Not just what it implied, what each of our experiences had been at the hands of the internet. Because
oh, really? So that was a real active conversation.
Yeah, he wrote it because he'd experienced some internet hate over something he'd either said or declared.
What's his name?
Nacho.
Nacho
Vigalondo. Doesn't it sound like I just made that up?
What are his other movies?
Time Crimes.
Okay.
He made a film called Extraterrestrial. And on iTunes, I believe you can buy a bundle of his short films called Confetti of the Mind.
Okay.
And those were what convinced me. Because I read the script and I loved it, and I thought, wow, this is, you know, like I said, so ambitious. But can he pull it off? Because, you know, that's a really important thing. And some of his short films look like it was just him, a buddy, an iPhone, and an afternoon. And they're great.
Right.
And they're clever, and they're entertaining, and they're screamingly funny.
Yeah. So you had a conversation about internet cowardice and hate.
Well, yeah, I mean, more...
I say cowardice because usually it's anonymous.
You know, it's I don't remember which one, but one of the guys who, one of the creators of the internet said, if we had had any idea where this was going to go, we never would have made it anonymous. And I think seeing it, I can see why, seeing all that's happened. And, you know, I have my own experience with it. And I can't help but think that we're all growing up together in this moment, and we've never quite had anything like this, the responsibility, the access, the protection, the anonymity, that ability to let our id run as unchecked as we want it to go. We've never had that before. And we're actually having a real conversation about it. People's reactions are genuine. People that are into it, people who get high off of hurting other people. It was the feeling that I had about it culturally going into my conversation with the director,
right,
which we had.
Right. It's weird because what happens, the reason why people a lot of times get attacked, and I was thinking about this today, that, who was I talking to? I just did RuPaul's podcast. I went over there just earlier today, and he mm-hmm. says hi, and he
oh
said,
oh my God, okay, I'm just dying.
Yeah.
Oh
and my he God. Said, he said, ask her about the Liza Judy thing that I heard that might happen, because mm-hmm. she's so like them.
Aw.
And what about those?
Well, first of all, that's very, very elevated company, and it might happen.
Really?
It might happen. It's there.
What's the angle?
There's a script underway. I can't tell you. It's too good. It's too good.
Well, who
I don't
are you going to play?
I'm of Judy.
Really?
Judy.
And you love her?
Oh, my God. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. I adore her. I think uh-huh. she was one of, I think she's so brave. I think she was a woman who, if Judy Garland lived today, we would have seen a very different version of her.
Uh-huh.
No less of the talent, no less of the feeling. But I think that both Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe and a few other women from that period, I thought they were emotional geniuses, totally ahead of their time. When you look at their level of inclusivity, they didn't see, they didn't particularly care about gender. They didn't care about sexuality. They just loved everybody. They just wanted to be loved. And so they loved everybody.
So that was and that was the thing that did it. It's a vulnerability almost.
Certainly. I mean, Judy Garland was so achingly vulnerable and also raw, so powerful raw. And so raw. I don't know if you've seen A Star Is Born lately.
I haven't seen it lately.
There's this scene in it where it's one take, and she's like a 3 or 4 minute monologue, and she's talking about her husband in the film who's an alcoholic. And you have to remember, like, this is before there were rehabs. This is before yeah. the term addict, I think, even existed. I mean, you know, people were just poking around in the dark trying to make
sure.
sense of these things.
She likes to have a good time. That's what they called addicts.
That's so dark. Speaking of dark.
Uh-huh.
And she has this monologue, and I saw behind the scenes of it, the making of thing.
Yeah.
And George Cukor, I think, was the director, and he went up to her, and it's a monologue about addiction, but without being called about addiction. And he said, "You know what this is about."
Oh, really?
And she said, "Yeah, I do." He goes, "Okay, rolling." And she just gives my favorite performance that anyone's ever. All due respect to Meryl Streep, who gives like all my other favorite performances.
Yeah.
It's the best acting I think anyone has ever done in that scene, where she goes with it. And then they're like, "We're ready for you on set." And she like leaves the shot and goes out into the background of another shot and just starts singing and dancing. It's crazy.
Show business.
Oh my God. And yeah. and that level of strength and the stories about her. This one won't be in the movie, but she was in so much pain, and she needed help so badly. And there are people around her who just didn't have it within themselves to give her that space. And I don't know if it was greed or fear or both or what.
Denial.
Maybe, yeah, that's a really strong one too. A very big possibility.
Yeah.
But they pulled her. She tried to commit suicide. They pull her out of the hospital because she had a show. She's saying, she's begging them not to take her through. She's saying, "I need a rest. I need a break. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this." And they're saying, "Judy, you're going on." Her mother was in the car with her. And then finally, she asks for a mirror. And now I must say, this is secondhand. I read this in a book. So
yeah.
Apologies to her children if
right.
this is not true. But they give her the mirror,
yeah,
and so she can do her makeup, and she takes the mirror and she smashes it and grabs a shard of glass and starts cutting her face.
Oh my God.
Because she didn't want to go on. And they got a doctor to the theater who stitched her up, and they covered it with her hair, and she went out and she did a show.
Oh, how long was that before she died?
20 years.
That, it's a God, to live in that.
Yeah. And so one of the things I want to do, by the way, I feel like I have to say this because I've just told a few, you know, tragic stories. I'm falling into the habit that people have with her, which is to focus on the aspects of her life that were tragic. One of the things that I want to do with the story and the way I want to tell the story is I want to show that she was an artist. She was a great mom. And because that aspect of her always, you always say that after you talk about all the heightened levels of tragedy that affected her in her life. She was this sublime artist. She had such greatness inside of her, and her talent saw her through so much. And I don't know. And she was a great wit. People don't know that about her. She was funny as anything.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I'm really excited for that project. It's been a long time coming.
When did that start to resonate with you? Because you started acting pretty young. And I mean, that was really, I think, when everybody saw her was, what, Wizard of Oz or the Mickey Rooney movies? I mean, she must have been very young and she was playing young.
Mm-hmm. She did a lot of Andy Hardy movies.
Yeah.
And then she got cast in The Wizard of Oz. And then she was sort of, I mean, it was such an awkward time because she wasn't quite grown up yet, but she wasn't quite the little girl that people wanted her to be. And so she lived in this uncomfortable place for much of her career, honestly.
And when did she start to resonate with you?
Well, I auditioned for, there's this made-for-television movie starring Judy Davis, and she's just incredible in
Judy
it.
Judy Davis is great.
She's amazing. And the girl that they want, I should get to the point of the story first. I auditioned to play young Judy Garland in that, and they cast.
When was this?
I think I was like 15, maybe,
uh-huh.
15, 16. And they cast a young actress named Tammy Blanchard who just, I mean, they're twins. She mm-hmm. did such a good job. And that was kind of when I started to really get into the story because there was a lot of backstory stuff that I didn't know.
But you seem to, on some level, avoided a crash and burn mode, as far as I can tell.
Publicly.
Yeah?
Publicly, yeah. But no. I crashed and burned like all of them.
Oh, yeah.
Behind closed doors, yeah. I'm just really lucky. I went to Vassar for a few years. And so I think a lot of that stuff was just chalked up to like college age.
Oh, you didn't lose control necessarily.
Behavior. No, I did.
Oh, yeah?
And
like what? What was your thing? I mean, when did it start? High school?
No. I was a teetotaler in high school. I was pretty righteous about it, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You drunk girls are bad news.
No, not even that. I just, it wasn't about judgment of other people.
Yeah.
It was a way of creating some kind of control in my own world.
Sure, yeah.
So I didn't smoke anything or drink anything till I was 18. And then you know how it is when you don't do it for a long time. You kind of go a little harder
sure.
than you should.
Yeah.
But it took, I mean, I remember, I just dropped the thing that I was That's hoping right. to calm me down. Excuse me. I can't even say that it's a thing that I've totally resolved. I think, you know, the
what?
Drinking.
Yeah.
The break that I got to take when I was trying to get pregnant and then pregnant and then, you know, breastfeeding.
Yeah.
It was a real gift. It was a real gift to just kind of learn how to bring it all down and be present. And honestly, like I was talking to someone today and about motherhood and they were just saying, you know, you seem to really be calm about it. And I said the fear, the anxiety was that I wasn't going to get pregnant. And now that I have, I just feel like I just get to enjoy the rest of my life. So I feel like because some of that anxiety is tamped down and because I don't want my son to have an impaired mom.
Right.
I think I hope that's quieted down. But I mean, if you talk to anybody who really knew me in my 20s, they would tell you I was a wild girl.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was so incongruous to people's idea of me that it never really got, you know, picked up. And it was never that dramatic. I think it was like a lot of people where I could drink a bottle of wine by myself every night.
Sure. You know, by yourself though?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I could.
Yeah.
Usually I'd rope someone else to help me, but I drank most of it.
Right. But it seems like you're able to manage your life, at least professionally.
I mean, I'm still going.
Yeah.
And it's going well, so that's good.
Well, when did you start? When did the acting start? Let's go back and then move through it. And I want to talk about that vulnerability, the Marilyn Monroe, Judy Garland thing. Because, like, I said something to RuPaul walking out, you know, about, like, you know, I know there's been a lot of attention paid to, you know, people who are, you know, have strong opinions about you one way or the other. And I said to him, well, I love her. Because, you know, when you can't help but be vulnerable in all your performances when mm-hmm. you can see that, which you do, which is a consistent thing with you. And it's an amazing thing.
Thank you.
That, you know, it doesn't matter what the character is. It's not that you're necessarily coming through because you're an actress, but that thing, that vulnerability, that humanity always comes through. And I say, well, that, there's a person that's going to be moved always by that and compelled by it, but it's also bully bait. I mean, that. You know what I mean? It's just
totally, totally.
That yeah, you know, yeah. vulnerability is like chum in the water to assholes.
Oh, that is a great line. Oh man,
good.
You I'm like lifting it. That and saying it in a movie. Oh,
yeah, do it. I don't even need credit. I'm glad to help out.
You'll get in the special thanks.
Is it hot in here?
Or you're is right? it just us?
Hey, oh, well,
I'm
I don't
okay.
know.
Honestly, I don't know what's wrong with me. I like this type of thing.
I don't mind it. I didn't know if it was like, the tea or it was happening to you. And I there's
am
nothing.
Am I turning red? I turn
no.
red a lot.
There's nothing I can do to. I can't turn the air on. I don't even. There's no reason for me to ask that.
I like a hot, stuffy room.
Yeah.
I don't know what's wrong with me. I like it.
Sometimes it's relaxing.
I agree.
It's like the humidity because I don't do any drugs or drink anymore. Like, but in the humidity. Like when I lived in New York, it's horrible, but it's you're so dead.
Yeah.
Like it's almost a replacement for doing drugs. You're just too exhausted.
I think that's why I like the ocean.
Yeah.
Because by the end of the day, you're spent.
Yeah, without
you've been
doing
sitting.
Anything. Yeah, just sitting right there. So let me tell you the backstory that I have with you because it's sort of, I don't even know if it's a great story to tell you. But after I saw Rachel's Getting Married, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
When did that come out? Like 2007, something like
2008,
that?
2008, yeah.
Right. So I was doing a show in New York, a streaming video show at Air America. You know, I was in the middle of a bad divorce. I was shattered and doing this daily video show, a political show mostly, but also whatever. It was just a show that nobody watched on the computer. And I went and saw that movie and I was like so amazed by you and by the movie. And I thought it was a great performance. But then I sort of started being like, do you think Anne Hathaway knows about this show? And I was doing it on the show. And like 2,000 people watch this at most on any given day. But it became this recurring theme. I wonder if I could get her to talk to me, if she would come up.
Funny.
But it went on for months. And of course, you didn't know anything about that. But it was this recurring theme with me that like someday I'm going to talk to Anne Hathaway.
I'm going to high five across the table.
Yeah, it's a big day. So, but what happened was with all that kind of like going on every day, which wasn't all that, but it was on my mind.
But it's a real, you were going through some real stuff.
Sure. But like you weren't going to solve it.
Certainly not.
But I think that my intuition that maybe you might doesn't seem to be that off character logically.
Well.
Yeah. So anyway.
I'm just amazed and flattered by everything you're saying, and I'm fighting really hard not to leave my body right now. I'm fighting really hard to take all this in.
So what happens, I'm in New York, right? And one time just walking, was probably down 3rd Avenue. It was downtown because I never went anywhere but downtown. And you were just walking. You were just walking by yourself. And I know from, being a, mid-level celebrity myself that there's nothing I could have, like, if I did have eye contact with you, but there was no way it was going to register as anything to you other than like, uh-oh. But, there's no, because even when people are trying to act cool, and you know this, their eyes widen just a little. Like, mm-hmm. even when they're trying to keep it together, there's that, like a half a centimeter of like, oh, shit. And you can't, it's involuntary. So I imagine that happened. But I saw you, and after all this talking about, talking to you, there was nothing I could do that wouldn't seem, like, fucking creepy.
You could have said, Jersey girl.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that.
But I would have turned.
Oh, it probably would have been more like, help. Anne, you don't understand. You're the only one that can help me.
For the record, I would have hugged you.
Oh, really?
I would have hugged you.
Yeah, no one would have believed it.
I would have hugged you. I feel so much more comfortable giving people hugs than I do taking selfies.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I'll go either way. If the selfie, like, it's quicker than, like, what really becomes a chore, because you seem like a good person in terms of people that love you or your fans, is that it's like you want to, they know you in a certain way, whatever information's out there. There's a lot of information about me because I never shut up and I talk. But they have this relationship with you that they're walking into and you don't know. You don't know
no,
them.
No, I don't.
And they could go either way. But sometimes they're sort of like, well, let's catch up. And
well, can I tell you where I hold it?
Yeah.
And I didn't always. And I've got to say, I hope I wasn't a jerk to anybody, but in my head, I was a jerk to people a lot for a period of time. And I just woke up one day and I just became so deeply flattered by it. And I just saw it for what it is, which is just, it's just somebody giving you some of their energy in a nice way.
Right.
And it's really not that hard to stand there and just
exactly be gracious.
Say, thank you so much.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if it's motherhood or just growing up a little bit, but people's time matters.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want with it, and you choose to give it to me.
Yeah.
Either like by watching my movies or in this moment by telling me that I make you feel good. Yeah. Holy shit, that's amazing.
Right. No, that's great. But then comes the point where it's like, I'm not done yet. But yeah, exactly.
Well, you seem to be doing really well now.
I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The time, did it turn into grist for the mill?
Oh, yeah. No, I got through all that. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know.
You didn't need me.
No, I did. but no, things work out. You had your problems.
Yes. Again and again and again and again. I still will, still looking forward to them finding me again.
But you got a good one now.
What's my problem now?
No, you got a good relationship now.
Oh, I got a good relationship now.
So, okay, well, this is something we could talk about, maybe. What did you have to do to, you know, sort of recover from some of the bad ones? Like, what did you, like, how did you reconcile that with yourself? How did you figure out who you were in that?
You know, I'll tell you the moment. I've been dating my husband for about a year.
Yeah.
And I knew he was a good guy, and I intuited, but I hadn't absorbed and owned yet.
Yeah.
That I should be grateful to all the bad relationships, because without them, I don't know that I would have known how to appreciate my husband.
Right.
I think I might have said, oh, he's a nice guy. I'm sure there's lots of nice guys out there.
Right.
Because I knew for a fact that there are actually way more not nice guys out there from my own experience, that this guy was rare and I should be good to him. And about a year into our relationship, as you know, I think probably happens to most people, I started to be my real self. And the same stuff that had happened with the bad guys showed up.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, it wasn't all them. It was a little bit me. And I remember this one moment I was, you know, thinking about my husband, talking to him. And honestly, if I'm being 100% honest, and he knows this, I was disparaging him in my mind. And not being kind.
Yeah.
And who I am now, knowing that he is my husband and the father of my child and the king of my life, reached back in time and slapped me myself upside the head and said, hey, honey, this is not the one that you do that with. All right? You have a choice. You either never have a guy this good again or you grow up a little bit. So,
right.
And I just went, oh, all my old BS is not going to serve this. I have to figure out a way to be better. And I was really upfront with him about it, and I've always been upfront with him that, you know, I don't really deserve someone this great, but if you're willing to hang with me, I'll be my best self with you always. That best self might not be good enough for what you should actually have. Right.
I like that even in the self-realization moment, you're undermining yourself.
Can't help it.
You know, I just want to be honest. I'm kind of shitty.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I want to be honest. I'm kind of shitty. I hope I'm not always shitty, but there's a chance I might be.
Could get pretty shitty.
There's some shittiness in here.
Right.
You know?
But I'm aware of the shitty.
I'm aware that this is a really important first step. I'm not one of those people that doesn't think they're shitty.
No, right. And it is an important first step, because, you know, that self-awareness. And the weird thing is that what you realize at that moment is that, like, you know, I somehow am part of the sabotaging.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like I've been saying on stage lately that, you know, if you're emotionally fucked up, it's not going to get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all you can do is learn how to shut the fuck up.
Say more about that.
Well, I mean that, like, for me, I don't know what your trip is, but like, I'll say things that are hurtful. Sometimes I'll get mad. I'll rage out. Like, when I feel hurt or manipulated or defensive, you know, even if I'm making it up, mm-hmm. like the woman mm-hmm. I'm with now said recently, when I was, you know, she did something that, you know, I registered differently, and there was nothing said, but like, you know, a few minutes go by and I'm like, I know what you're doing. And I feel, you know, like I started having this conversation. She's like, whatever conversation you're having, you're having it with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And that was sort of enlightening. And but more about it is just that I would lash out prematurely. And it was really about a fear of being intimate, of trusting someone else.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So I would preempt that by being a dick.
Sounds familiar.
Right. So that's what I mean by shutting up. It's like, don't say the thing that's, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, take a walk, suck it up, you know, try not to stew, and eat something.
Eat something. Start there. Start there. There's a couple things that you should try first.
What do you got?
Well, one of them, I mean, the one that I want to say is inappropriate to say. We just met. But if the microphones weren't here, I'd tell you what it is.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, of course. Well, that's right when things are about to get shitty. That's the time.
Try it.
That's foreplay.
Try it.
Hey, we're fighting.
Or.
Well, that's gotten pretty weird, too, like with me. Because like a lot of times when I'm at the most intimate place there and I start picking, you know, like, what happened this morning? You know, like you're in bed and you should be like, and it feels intimate. So then I start like, ugh. And I start picking a fight. And she said to me, I get it. This is your foreplay. And I'm like, I wish it was
she
healthier.
Sounds great.
I know, but I wish it was
she
more
sounds
healthy.
Really
why
awesome.
Can't we have regular foreplay? Why does foreplay have to involve me almost making you cry?
Trust deeper. You're going to get there. But the other thing I was going to say, it was great advice that I got, which was you set your timer 12 minutes and you write everything that's on your mind, just everything. You just get it out.
Oh my God.
And at the end of 12 minutes, you burn it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's almost like a magical ritual.
Yeah, it is actually. And there's something so wonderful about all this stuff that was literally weighing you down, keeping you couldn't see straight. You're ready to be mean to the people you love. You're ready to forget who you are. You're really like on the edge. And all of a sudden, it's smoke and ash.
Hmm.
In a moment.
And that works?
It works for me great.
Really?
Yeah.
So
I have to say, though, sometimes I'll be on set and I feel myself working up and I have to go outside and the paparazzi's there and I have to find a way to burn paper, without getting photographed having people make up weird stories.
Yeah. The tabloids are like, what is she up to?
What is that witch
what
up to?
What is she burning?
My feelings, okay? I can't eat them. I'm on set.
It's hard not to eat on set. Holy shit.
That was one of the things I loved about this movie because I was pregnant. I was like, it all works.
Yeah, where's craft services? Oh, man.
I ate more than the boys on this one.
That's more than the gaffers and the camera guys?
Oh, all of them.
Wow.
Great.
Good for
you. The last time I had this much fun on a set eating was Rachel getting married because my character, I decided, only ate white things.
Oh, yeah.
And I just ate carbs and carbs and carbs and carbs. It was so much fun.
Well, where did that come from? That like those. Let's talk about that because you're an actress, and you're a great one.
Thanks.
When did you start doing that?
Acting. My mom's an actress. She's a wonderful actress and an extraordinarily lovable one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up watching her do it
on stage.
Yeah. So I knew that it was something that you know, could do. And I knew that occasionally there would be kids in her shows. And so I would ask my parents, can I do that?
Yeah.
So they like signed me up for lessons. And I, in New Jersey, there's this theater. Maybe you actually even know it.
I don't know.
The Paper Mill Playhouse.
I don't think so. I think I was out before.
Okay. And there was a wonderful woman there who's since passed, but just changed my life. And her name was Mickey McNanny.
Yeah.
And she was just exactly the teacher that you want to have when you're like a slightly too loud, slightly too energetic kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was in her class for a long time. I did the theater camp that she had during the summer. And then the Paper Mill Playhouse.
How old were you?
At that point, that was probably from like 9 until about 12.
Yeah.
And then, I'd taken dancing lessons since I was little. And then I got asked to be an extra in a production of Gigi with Gavin McLeod from The
Gavin
Love Boat
McLeod,
and
sure,
Lillian Montevecchi.
From Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah, yeah. And that was fun. And then I got to audition for another show they were doing, and I got like the tiniest part you could have in it.
Yeah.
And one night I got to go on in one of the roles I understudied, and that was pretty cool. And there were a lot of other kids in the show, and some of them had agents.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to those agents when I was about 13.
On your own?
About 13, 14. Yeah, actually.
Who's representing you?
It's a real conversation theater kids have. And so, and I reached out and a couple of them called me and I went and I met with them. And one of them said, let's do a trial period.
Uh-huh.
And I booked my fourth audition and then didn't book like the next 150, but I had booked one, so they kept me on.
So you got hip to the rejection process.
Oh, really early, yeah.
And it didn't crush you all the time.
No,
you knew
I
was part of it.
Here's the thing. It's not about whether or not you get crushed. It's about whether or not you stand up again. So I got crushed a lot. And sometimes, I mean, my mom, I think, told People magazine or something a story about me sobbing on the floor when I was 15 years old because I'd gotten like my 90th rejection in a row, and Tara Lipinski had just won gold and we were the same age.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, see, other people are accomplishing things at a high level.
So you're a real perfectionist.
I used to be, not anymore.
All right, so let's go back to where you get cast in The Princess Diaries, if we can.
Okay, yeah.
So you're a kid, 90 rejections, things aren't going well.
More than 90, that was just that was a streak. And then I took an acting class at the Barrow, Group.
What is that?
The Barrow Group is a wonderful off-Broadway theater company in New York that my mom had taken a class at. She, when I was about three, had done a production at Summerstock of Evita. She was the matinee Ava.
Mm-hmm.
She's fantastic. I still have a VHS of it. I just don't have a player.
And both your folks are still with us? They are, yeah.
They are. They're still with us. They're still married.
Wow.
They're still really fun.
That's great.
And so one of the dancers in the show, an amazing actress by the name of Lee Brock, she and my mom had recently reconnected and said, you know, my husband and I have started this acting school. And my mom said, well, I want to take a class. And so she went to the class and just raved about it.
Yeah.
And I had been trying to find an acting class, and I wasn't having much luck. And my mom mentioned it to Lee and said, Annie really likes the sound of your class. Can she come? And Lee was like, oh, we don't really accept teenagers.
How old were you?
At the time, I was 15.
Okay.
And she said, we really don't take teenagers. And my mom, you know, was so great. She's like, oh, she's really mature. You won't even notice her age. And I think as a courtesy, they let me audition. And I worked really hard. And I think they saw something in the raw material. And I got to join an adult acting class. And it was not for like adult actors in the porn way.
Yeah.
But just anyway, that sounded weird. So but with real adult acting people, professionals in New York.
I don't think anyone would have thought that.
Brain goes there.
I didn't even think about
permanently
that.
Permanently 13 and male. So I was in this class with these unbelievable actors. And after I did that, I felt like I had taken a kind of a leap forward. And I went to my agent, who I'd been with at this point for a few years. And I said, I think I'd like to do movies. Like, I think I'd like to start auditioning for movies. I see other girls my age in them. And...
Did you learn anything in that acting class that you still use?
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely.
Like what?
Okay, one of the ones is if you have something where it's a bunch of like adjectives or I'm just describing objects in a room.
Yeah.
Imagine them like a grocery list.
Okay.
So people try to imbue each one with feeling, but if they're just objects, you know, you're just, you're doing it most of the time, you're thinking of something else. The other one, which is so helpful, is when you find yourself acting, like you find yourself aware that you're performing, just stop, have a conversation. And when you feel like you're actually talking to somebody, say your line. When you feel yourself actually relaxed enough, then you just slip into it and you bring the whole thing down to the level of reality.
So this is when you're working on it, not in the middle of a play.
No, you can't really do it in the middle
of a play.
Or
the middle of a movie scene. You could do another take.
But he, one of the things that our teacher, Seth Barish, who's Lee's husband.
Why do I know that name? Is that a name?
He's an actor.
Okay.
He's an actor in New York. You've seen it. If you showed your face, you'd be like, that guy.
Yeah.
He's such a good director too. And I remember him telling us the most exciting thing that happens on stage is usually when an actor forgets a line.
Yeah.
Because suddenly everyone's right back in the moment and nobody knows what's about to happen, including the actors themselves. And that's the moment when great stuff happens.
Right.
So I'm going to sidetrack for a second. My mom was in a production at the Barrow Group.
Yeah.
Called Sonnets for an Old Century.
Yeah.
And there was this, she had a monologue in it, and she was there, and one night she went up on her lines, and she couldn't remember what the next line was, and she just remembered that thing about don't panic, everyone's going to switch on, everything's going to be fine. And so she just held it and looked around the room, she said, it's going to come, I know it's going to come, and she said, and I'm not going to do anything until it does, and just stood there, and right when the audience like started to be like, what is going on, she remembered the line, which was... I like to take my time. And she used it. And she used it in the performance from that point on.
So those two things.
So I said I'd like to do movies.
Yeah.
My agent said, I don't think you're ready for that. But maybe you should go to L.A. for pilot season. And I said, what's that?
Yeah.
And she said, okay, maybe don't go to L.A. You're a little green. But anything that comes through New York, we're going to have you audition for. And one of the things I auditioned for was a show called Get Real. And I got it, and I got on they asked me to come out to Los Angeles. It was the second time in my life I was on an airplane.
Yeah.
The first time had been when I went to Disneyland World when I was 9.
Right.
And I got the part, and I lived in L.A. for a year, and then went
home. Did your mom come out with you?
No. My older brother came out with me for the first few months, and then my mom, my dad, and my aunt took turns, and one would come out for 2 weeks. But in hindsight, we all think that's insane.
Yeah. Someone should have been here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we were out of respect for my younger brother, who was you know, quite young at the time. I think he was like 11, 12.
Yeah.
It would have been really disruptive to have moved the entire family
sure.
out here from my dream. We got picked up for 13 episodes initially, and we never had good ratings, so we never knew how comfortable we could get.
Right.
So given the givens, I know why we made the choice, but just in hindsight, knowing what we know now, knowing how tough that time was, I don't think we would make that decision again.
Well, what happened for you out here in L.A. in terms of, like, it's weird to me that already at that point, I mean, you're younger than me, but like already that an acting coach could tell you you're too green to go out for pilot season if you don't know what it is and you're 15, that you're around, you know, that like you should be jaded and you should know about this. And mm-hmm. But when you came out here, what was your experience in Hollywood? I mean,
well, I was a senior in high school. When the show got picked up. So I came out here, I guess it was like spring break of my junior year.
Yeah.
And then I got picked up and I came out here senior year. And I had a private tutor.
Sure.
And I'd been a, you know, an okay student, like pretty average
yeah.
up to that point. And something about this teacher, whose name was Buzzy Gagné, just unlocked something.
Yeah.
And suddenly I could do things that I just wasn't able to do back
yeah.
home. I could speak other languages. I could, you know, remember details about art. The way she taught me revealed to me that I actually had a good brain. Before that, I didn't really think.
Was it a confidence thing, a fear thing, or what?
I just think it was
natural evolution.
I think all of the above.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think just having someone, I just think it was a great privileged gift to be able to learn at the pace that I wanted to learn at, which was to say uneven. Some things I got right away, other things I got way slower than everybody else. And to have somebody who got to know me and got to work with me
yeah.
on that. And she just, I mean, she was so cool. Like, you know, sometimes like if I had a day off from shooting, because what I did most of the time was work. But if I had a day off from shooting, we would go to a museum and we would just exhaust the museum. And then
yeah.
we would read all about the artists in that period. And it was so cool. Anyway, the show ended. I went home for the last like 6 weeks of my senior year.
Yeah.
I went on a couple auditions. One of them was for a film called The Other Side of Heaven, which shot in New Zealand. I had a 24-hour stopover in Los Angeles and I auditioned for The Princess Diaries.
So you got cast in that New Zealand movie and you auditioned for The Princess Diaries.
Yeah.
And you got it.
And I got it.
And that was a big deal.
It was a big effing deal, man.
That was
a really big deal.
That was the big break.
It was. That yeah. was the really, really, it was unusual. If nothing else had happened to me, I would have had a great career.
Because that was like one of those huge, like Harry Potter level things, wasn't it?
I mean, not quite Harry Potter.
No, but I mean, at that time, it had a big impact on.
It was a sleeper.
Yeah.
It was a sleeper and people were shocked at how well it did. And from my experience, it endures. I mean, there's a lot, for me, I work with someone, they have kids, and then
yeah.
all of a sudden they have a daughter who turns 7, and it's a whole new thing.
Yeah.
And suddenly, like, I come into focus, and I was just, like, another adult to their kid, and all of a sudden I'm something else.
Yeah.
And I like that, like, The Princess Diaries is sort of like, you know,
it's in
the movie for sleepovers.
Right. It's in the canon.
Yes.
In the little girl canon.
It's so in the little girl canon.
So that starts it, and obviously we can't go movie to movie. Okay, I got a question.
Okay.
I just thought of this on the way over from wherever I was, from RuPaul's place, yeah, from where he does his
I'm so
podcast.
Jealous you were with RuPaul.
You can go do a show.
I'm going to go
he would
right,
be
right
thrilled.
From here. I love him.
He would be thrilled
so
to have you on his podcast. Are you kidding?
The most fabulous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think he is in the dictionary under the most fabulous.
I think so.
But, okay, this is just a weird question because I don't know. Sometimes I miss things in movies. In Brokeback Mountain,
mm-hmm.
did you have him killed?
Oh, you've asked the question I swore I would never answer. Can I tell you a story?
Someone else has asked it, though, damn it.
Oprah.
Oh, interesting.
So,
that's good company. That's good company.
Here's what happened. So yeah. Oprah, so Brokeback Mountain comes out, and, you know, it's this little mini phenomenon.
Yeah.
And Heath, God rest his soul, and Michelle and Jake, they're just getting all the attention they deserve. And I'm there too. And somehow I'm just sort of being brought to every press thing. I think they're hoping, I don't know, that little girl's coming.
I love your character. I grew up in New Mexico.
Thank you very much.
It was very familiar to me somehow.
It just became very clear that, like, they were the top tier. Yeah. And I was sort of like not quite there.
Yeah.
But I still was going around doing all this press, but there wasn't much to talk to me about.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we all go on Oprah, which is like just a thrill, as I'm sure you can imagine. And we go on the show, and Oprah asks me a question, and I'm like, oh, okay, I guess that's my turn to talk. But I didn't understand the question. Then it turned out it was meant for Michelle.
Oh.
And so it's just like, I'm just sitting there. I'm like, I have nothing to do. I'm just occupying space.
Oh, come on. Yeah.
So then Oprah turns and she says to me, you know, so did Loreen know? Did she know that Jack was gay? And it's Oprah. And I've sworn to myself, this is why you can never be too rigid about anything, that I'm not going to answer this question. But it's Oprah, so I want to answer the question. But and Ang Lee, we had just done a Q&A, and someone had asked him that. And he said, well, you know, I think it's obvious, but I don't think it has to be stated. And I was like, I'm just going to borrow Ang Lee's answer.
Sure.
The thing is, though, when Ang Lee says it, it's different than when 21-year-old Anne Hathaway says it. So I say it, and I offend Oprah. I offend her.
She
goes,
say?
Oh, is it obvious, Anne? It's obvious. So I'm just not getting it. Like, it's obvious to everyone here. She turns to the audience.
Oh, my God.
And she's like, so everyone else gets it. And I'm like, oh, no, no. I literally had one thing to do here, and I did up.
You offended Oprah.
And so I just like kind of was like, I can't believe it. And I just said, I'm so sorry. My mother wants to kill me right now that I was disrespectful to you.
Right.
And I later found out that a director that I was dying to work with decided he didn't like me because of that interview.
You were just trying to be...
I was just trying to, like...
do the right thing for the movie.
And for my character. And I was just trying... Yeah, I was just trying to be cool.
So she knew.
I should never do.
She knew.
I can't answer that. If I didn't tell Oprah. No,
it's time has come. Time has come. And it's time to let this thing go. And to correct your... You know, it's an opportunity for you to grow as a person.
Is it?
Yeah, because you lied to Oprah. You condescended.
I did condescend to Oprah. Yeah. My God.
Right.
My God. And what is wrong with my inner compass?
And let me tell you something. If this is the biggest thing that we're going to break on this show, is if this is like, it's not like people are like, oh my God, run to the presses.
Mm-hmm.
The discussion was had, though. You knew as a character. Aang said to you, look.
What Aang said to me was, she's a predator.
That's it?
That was one of the biggest character notes he gave me, and I just sort of ran with that. Aang and I never had an overt discussion about what it was, and so what I did was, I did some takes where I knew, and I did some takes that I didn't know, and I saw both of those in the movie.
Okay. So that's...
Is that an acceptable answer?
It seems honest. You know, like I also am seeing the way you're. I think that you probably had the same tone when you answered Oprah.
Oh no, I've learned nothing. like I'm slightly better than you because you want to know and you won't just let it be.
Well, it's not like.
Oh, sorry, that's awful.
No, God. It's not. It's not. Well, it's not that. It was a question I thought driving over here. I didn't lose sleep for 2 weeks. Like, I'm going to get this out of her. This is the big,
this is the whole juicy podcast. Drop, man.
This is it. Okay, well, I can live with that. Now,
thank you. I can't.
You can't? Well,
what
are you going to go
it's
home and you're going
to be? Repeating itself. I condescended Oprah. I condescended Mark Maron.
No, I don't think you condescended me. I think I believe what you're saying.
Thank you. Good.
So it still leaves it unanswered, but, you know, now it's just more of a puzzle. Mm-hmm. Like, if anybody really wants to, like, I'm going to go back and watch that movie and figure out which takes she knew and which takes she didn't.
And also, the point is, you know, that stands, that the point is that he, neither of them got to live a life that made them
happy.
No,
I get the point of the movie, but your character. that's not what we're talking about. You can't, there's no way to brush it under the.
Yeah, you're right.
But I'll take it. So here's a, I'll admit some more things to you.
Okay.
I've probably seen Devil Wears Prada like 7 times. For some reason, I love the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I love your dynamic with her. And like, it's a guilty pleasure. I'll watch, I don't seek it out. I don't have a copy that I'm like, it's that night, you know.
Bad day at work. Yeah, pop it in. Well, no, you said you have Apple TV, so click the button.
Exactly. But I'll watch it whenever it's on.
Thank you.
Now, when you knew you were going to work with Meryl Streep, what was the first, the day you heard you were going to do it, what was your first feeling?
I knew, so I had been the studio's choice.
Yeah.
Before Meryl was on board. And this is some real...
This
stuff.
Is a real dirt.
This is real dirt.
Yeah.
When they got Meryl, they thought they could do better than me.
Oh, really?
So I fell down on the list, and they went to a lot of girls before me. And for some reason,
did you know the girls they went to
personally or their names?
Their names.
I knew their names.
How do you get that information in that situation?
And sometimes I ask. Sometimes I've learned I actually don't want to know anymore.
Yeah.
But in that case, I was just like, well, who are they going to now?
Yeah.
Oh, God, she's great. And for some reason, and I think, and this is, you know, one of the
definitely
things
that, not a predator in real life. Oh, that makes sense. Oh, I'm not good
she
enough.
Would be good.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, and I don't want to use words like fate.
Yeah.
They all said no to this fantastic part. They just, and the opportunity to work with Meryl Streep. And there's no, I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like number 7 or 8 on the list. Like, it got turned down by a lot of people. And I was there waiting, you know, just with my hand up. And so when I found out that it was actually going to happen, I mean, I was beside myself. I remember I was getting dressed and I wasn't wearing pants.
Ready to go.
And I was ready to go out with my friends. And I just ran out, like my shirt half off, not wearing pants. And I screamed, I'm like, I got it. I'm going to be in the Devil Wears Prada.
Where was paparazzi that day?
They didn't care about me at that point.
Oh.
And so it was just so happy. And then a couple weeks later, I met Emily, and I just, you know, when you just meet someone, you're like, whoa, you're going to be really important to my life. I don't know how. And I met my husband through her, like many, many years later.
Through Emily?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Meryl, and she was just so, I mean, for lack of a more interesting word, she's just a real living, breathing human.
Yeah.
You know, she's so alive and switched on. And I know Mike Nichols once described her as like an irrepressible spring.
Yeah.
And she's just, I mean, she's all of those things, and she's so smart, and she just lives her life so in the moment. She's so playful.
But how did you feel as an actress?
I mean, I don't know.
You didn't think about it?
How do you feel in that moment? What don't you feel in that moment?
What were you looking forward to?
Just seeing.
Being around her.
See, I was really looking forward to seeing the cogs, if there were any.
That's what I'm wondering, yeah.
And I remember doing the read through, and at that, so we talked about my acting class, and the first thing that my teacher had me do, which was, you know, so painful. I thought I knew what acting was, and acting was like being really big and shouting your lines and being very theatrical.
Yeah,
and that comes very easily to me, unfortunately. And he had me...
Not in a musical. It's a good thing to have.
In a musical, in a big theater, it's a great thing to have. It's just not appropriate for every scenario, right, as I have learned.
Yeah.
And so he had me say the first line probably like 25 times until I just didn't know what to do and was so broken down that I just spoke it. And he's like, great, there you go. Now do the whole scene like that. And I was just baffled by the whole thing. And so when I get nervous, some of the bigness kind of just
comes
in. And so I was really nervous at the read-through. And so the bigness has come in, and we're all like, you know, it's a read-through, it's this, no one's expecting anything great.
Yeah.
And then Meryl just whispers the first line as Miranda, which I had thought she was going to, I mean, in my lack of imagination, lack of experience self, I just thought she was going to play it like barking and do this and do that. And,
right.
You know, and the fact that she whispered.
Yeah.
And everyone in the room got silent, still, and we all leaned forward.
Uh-huh.
It was just, I don't think I'll ever forget it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, and I just thought, oh, brilliant. And suddenly everyone got like 90% better in their acting. And then she cared so much about the look of the character. She worked harder than anybody on that movie. And it was just, I just remember the way she can make everything really still. you know, when she wants to. And you know that scene where all the makeup's off and you find out that they're divorced? I have never seen a crew be more aware that something's about to happen. And everyone worked as quickly as I've ever seen them work, as quietly as I've ever seen them work. Everyone just, nobody wanted to interrupt. And there was just such respect paid her in that moment, in the way people did their jobs. It was unreal. So,
and that's the kind of thing you only see if there's nudity, usually.
No,
so there's this emotional nudity, and they were equally as respectful.
Yeah, yeah, and they were. Well, you hope that people be respectful. I've had it both ways.
Uh huh. Oh, with real nudity?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a really skeevy thing happen to me my first nude experience.
When was that?
That was it was a film. It was a film called Havoc.
Right.
Which is notable for being Channing Tatum's first film.
Okay.
And there's a scene in it where I sort of pull my bra down and I'm trying to seduce this character. It's a very sad scene.
Yeah.
And I was really scared about it, and we'd asked the whole crew to clear out. I had the thing, whatever it's called, where only the most...
Close set.
Yeah, clear set. Thank you. And I did the first take, and I did it, and they all cut, and I look up, and two crew guys had snuck into the upstairs and watched the whole thing. And I just remember turning and being like, there's somebody upstairs, and I'm 19 years old, and
yeah.
And they just gave me the dirtiest smiles on their way out. It was so horrible.
Men.
Some men.
Yeah.
Some men.
Sure. Crew guys.
Couple of
dirty crew guys.
Those dirty crew guys.
Yeah, there's some good ones and there's some bad ones.
It's not all Julie Andrews songs and Meryl Streep scenes.
So I thought you held your own very well in that scene and in that whole movie. But you went back to school. Like, you were already a working actress. You decided to go back to college go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're like, this might not work out. Or was it because you did 2 years at Vassar and then you switched?
Switched to NYU, yeah.
Because you were so shit-faced all the time at Vassar.
So
you had to get leftist, burned all your bridges and embarrassed yourself, and you had to go to another college.
Because I was so, I kept leaving. So all my friends had graduated.
Oh, because you're working.
And Poughkeepsie is, yeah. And the truth is, I mean, I honestly can't take credit for any kind of I wanted to go to college and improve myself. I wanted to work. I just wasn't booking jobs. I booked The Princess Diaries and I didn't book anything to follow it up. So I went to college. I was not psyched about going, and it turned out to be one of the best things that's ever happened to me.
And you transferred to an acting program or no?
No. I was studying. I mean, I wasn't at Bass for long enough to declare a major.
Right.
But I was going to be an English major with an emphasis on poetry.
Oh, good.
One of those useful degrees.
I did that. English emphasis on film studies. Well, who's your favorite poet?
What a question. I love Rumi.
Oh, yeah.
I love E.E. Cummings.
Oh, yeah.
My husband just read me a Baudelaire poem the other day.
That's the first time you heard a Baudelaire poem?
No. I'd read some, but it hadn't resonated with me that
Which
way.
Which one?
The Love of Lies.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's heavy stuff from Flowers of Evil, I guess, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But when I was at school, my favorite poet was William Blake.
Oh, yeah, did you like his paintings too?
Yes. Do you know that coffee table book, which is the illuminated William Blake?
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
He was out there, man. I'm just going to build my own mythology.
He was out there.
Yeah.
In a way that I aspire to be out there like.
Yeah. You want to be Blakeian out there?
I mean, I kind of can now because I have a kid. And I have to, but in
stay
another
a little
version
grounded.
Of this.
Stay grounded for the kid.
A little bit. That's a lot to ask a kid to take on.
I guess what I was coming around to is that in watching you work with Merle, because you're both powerful, great actresses, but it seems like your approach is fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
In that, Merle Streep obviously is this singular thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you said, there's always that engaged with life thing at the core of all of the work that she does to put these characters together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, even in picturing that scene, is like, I'm always conscious that one thing that you, when you watch Meryl Streep work, you're like, all you're thinking is like, she's really amazing at this.
Yes.
Like, you get locked into the character, but then you're like, holy shit, she can do anything.
Yeah.
But in that scene in particular, which is a good example, where she's stripped down and it is an emotional scene and you've got to know two things, that you shouldn't be there,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that you have to be there for her in that moment, right? And it just seems to me that for you, like, it, you're very present, and that particular responsibility emotionally is like, you probably, how did you deal with that? It just seems to me that you're emotionally present all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm not sure she is.
Oh, I think from what, based on my, that one time I had with her on the film, she is. She is emotionally,
even
emotionally
with present. When she, like, when she, when the camera stops, she comes out.
No, well, no, but because what she did was she stayed in character the whole time, okay. And so she was very quiet in between takes. But I remember, you know, I would be so nervous, and I was so young, and I just loved her so much, I couldn't hold my tongue all the time. And so, you know, I just discovered Nick Drake, and so I wanted to talk to her about Nick Drake, and so she, you know, oh, that's very interesting. And do you want me to bring you a CD
in character?
That would be very, oh, very nice. Funny. and then you know, I remember this, you know, huge. I'm a huge. So,
but
fan,
you were
of
being you.
Yeah, and there was a, you know, Venn diagram. There's a little bit of overlap.
But,
there.
Yeah, but that's funny though, because that dynamic is really kind of played itself out in the movie.
But I remember one day we were stuck in traffic together. We were just filming us getting out of a car, and we had to go around the block, and we're stuck in traffic. And it just, at a certain point, we had to talk.
Yeah.
Like, even if, I think it got to be too much for her, and I started to ask her if she watched The Daily Show, and because Jon Stewart was hosting it at the time, and it was, you know, such an important thing for me. And so I was telling her about it, and she's listening, and I think I'm sounding like really smart, like talking about The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And then I turned around, like, you know, I actually think, you know, in this moment, I really think Jon Stewart is saving us.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, ooh, I just said something so smart.
Yeah.
And she goes, takes this really long pause. She goes, I think Stephen Colbert is. And Colbert had only been on the air for a couple weeks, and I hadn't watched the show yet, and I just was like, oh, I don't have anything to say to that. So I just shut up. But in terms of that scene, to get to your original question, was we had shot the scene in the hotel,
mm-hmm.
and I observed the way the crew was, and that level of, you know, when silence almost has a tone.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered that tone, and on that day, I intuitively just tried to listen for that tone.
Yeah.
And it was the right thing to do for the scene. And that tone came back in the car. And this time I knew that's what I want to do. I want to listen to it. And I knew that Andy had come far enough in her journey that she didn't need to shout her feelings anymore.
Right.
She was in a quiet car with a quiet woman, and she knew that she would be heard at a lower volume. And so that was the choice I made.
Oh, it's a good one.
I like your knife, by the way.
Oh yeah, thank you. I don't know where I inherited that, but it's been around for a while.
It's a really good one. I mean, it wouldn't be great in a fight because it's kind of hard to get out.
Oh, knife fight, how horrible!
I know.
I like the Catwoman. I liked you in that.
Thank you very much.
I thought it was very theatrical, and you were big, and I thought it called for that.
Thank you.
Les Mis, great.
Thank
I'm just gonna
you.
Do this thing, I guess. Now musicals, you like doing them?
I do love. I really do love them.
And that was such a big one.
That, I mean, gosh, and it was one my mom did when I was a girl.
Oh.
I saw my mom play the same part that I played in it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Nice thing to have in common.
And also, I'll be honest with you, I've watched The Intern 4 times.
Really?
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel like your best pair of sweatpants?
You know what I'm amazed at? You know, you were great, but like, I don't think people really realize what an amazing job he did.
Bob De Niro?
Yeah.
How amazing is he in that movie? I agree
with
you.
It's like one of the best things he's done in 20 years.
I agree with you. He was such a, so delightful, so such a pro. And I mean, like, he's Bob De Niro. I didn't have to care. And he cared so much.
Oh, my God.
And he just created this warm, wonderful character. And I could tell, like, he would be sitting in his chair. He would be Bob. They would say, you know, it's time to work. And he would walk 10 steps to his mark. And he would transform into Ben. It was a subtle thing, but it was there every single take. It was really, amazing.
I thought he built that guy from the inside out.
Absolutely.
And it was completely different, you know, from anything I've seen from him. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, he knows how to do comedy now. But that wasn't really a comedy. And there was no menace to that guy. You know, it was really like a stunning thing.
And he was just playing the kind of guy that I love to see.
Yeah.
You know, he was playing a really interesting gentleman. Someone who, you know, was affable but had a definite point where, you know, I will go no further.
Right.
On this.
Exactly.
I like that.
He had principles.
Yeah.
There was a lot in there. I don't, you know, it's weird because I always talk highly about that movie. And I don't know if that's weird, but it seems like one of those movies that are people are like, well, that seems like a for regular people or older people. Like, who goes to that movie? You know, but I was like, it's a good movie.
You know, I've had a lot of guys, like kind of like big, like dudes who, for lack of a word, like work out, come up to me and just be like, I love The Intern.
Right.
I just think, you know, it's a term you don't hear too much anymore. It's a feel-good movie.
It's a feel-good movie, and also the dynamic of respect between you two is like there's something unique and very touching about it, about not just the age gap, but also that, you know, you're a powerful woman, and he's this guy that's had a life that is not, you know, is being, you know, respectful and not, you know, overshadowing, but then, you know, it becomes revealed that there's a lot to learn. You just don't, you don't see it.
And I think the secret strength of that film is its sweetness. And and sweetness is something that, you know, it's really hard because you get it wrong. It's treacly, it's saccharine, it's cloying, it's awful.
Yeah.
But if you can actually like get like sweetness like nectar, ooh, that's the best.
Yeah, my favorite. Yeah, well, you're a great movie star.
You're so kind. Thank you. It's been like an ego bath for me.
Has it?
Totally. Oh my God, are you kidding
me?
I
don't do that too often. I didn't know how it was going to go, you know.
Well, thanks for all the nice things you said about me and my movies. And
what?
I don't know. I just like want to go back in time and give you a hug on Third Avenue.
Well, you can,
2009.
I'll take it. It's great talking to you.
It's lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
She hugged me after. That was, I'm sorry, I'll outro. That was me talking to Anne Hathaway. She did hug me after. We took a selfie. It was a good selfie. I gave her a fancy mug. I finally got to talk to her. All right, enough. I don't want my girlfriend to get crazy. They get jealous even when things are, you know, not even possible. WTFpod.com/tour. Go get the tickets to the things. All right? It's all there. Portland, Madison, Milwaukee, Minneapolis for the special on the 29th. Two shows. And then Philly and D.C. WTFpod.com/tour. I'll play some guitar. I didn't think about it much. Boomer lives!